the real problem is the vocabulary problem of RF energy is called RF radiation. It's really sad that the original engineers, when they were studying this back at the turn of the century, around 1900, they should have called it radio transmission and radio signaling. But they called it RF radiation. Perfectly good word. You heard me say until nuclear radiation came along. So nuclear radiation, RF radiation, they got the same word, radiation. And yes, they both send out signals in all directions. They do radiate, but other than that, they have nothing in common per se. So one is kind of dangerous, and the other one absolutely is not, within reason. And if RF radiation was so dangerous, almost every one of us allows our food to be cooked in a microwave oven. I may have told you that there was a person, a very well-educated person, but he was a computer expert, not an RF expert, at one of the meetings at the Long Island Consultants Network that took place a couple of years ago. He came up to me, he says, hey, you know a lot about RF, let me drop this. He said, but I cook my food in a microwave oven, and I take the food out of the oven. How long should I wait for the half-life for the radiation to die down before I eat the food? I said, I'm going to give you an answer, and you're not going to believe it. The answer is approximately 1 nanosecond. He said, is that the half-life? I said, no. That's how long it takes for the last cycle out of the microwave oven magnetron to die down when you turn it off. About a nanosecond. And the signal coming out of the microwave oven magnetron has gone away. Did it irradiate your food? Absolutely not. That RF energy hit your food and heated it, and it cooked your food, or heated it up when it was cold. But did it make your food radioactive? Absolutely not. But he knew his RF radiation in that microwave oven. Therefore, he assumed his food is being irradiated, and he assumed there's a half-life involved in that RF radiation, similar to nuclear radiation. He really believed that. So we had quite a laugh over that one. I didn't laugh at him. He was acting in the logical manner of a good computer maven who didn't have RF experience. You can't blame a person who doesn't know what he doesn't know. From his point of view, he asked a logical question, and inwardly I was laughing, but I didn't tell him that. I didn't belittle him as I gave him the answer. And it took a while to convince him that the answer was reasonable. I told him a nanosecond, he had a scowl on his face. He didn't think any kind of a half-life of a nanosecond is possible. And what's really going on there is that the water is the major ingredient in your food that gets heated in the microwave oven. Let me drop this. You can take a very old, stale piece of bread that's very dry. Put it in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water. You got to put the glass of water there to act as a standard load. Because with nothing but the dry bread in there, which has no water, the microwave oven will think it's empty. And there's a slim chance you'll damage the microwave oven. And you turn it on for, let's say, a full power output for a minute. At the end of the minute, the glass of water is almost boiling, and the piece of bread is ice cold. There's no water in it. The majority of what cooks your food is water, liquid water. Water is a bipolar molecule. The RF energy at 2.45 gigahertz is a pretty strong field, radio field, in that microwave oven. On each half cycle, each individual water molecule is flipping back and forth following that voltage waveform. You could call it the physical motion of the water molecules in your food is being moved by the strong E field of that microwave oven signal bouncing back and forth in the oven, and that's what's heating your food. And that's the problem. If you put an ice cube in your microwave oven alongside of a glass of water and you run the oven full blast for a minute, the water will be almost boiling. You'll see a little bit of frost on the ice cube. Some of the steam coming off the glass of water deposits itself on the ice cube, but the ice cube didn't even begin to melt. Water in liquid form has got a dielectric constant of 81. Each of the individual water molecules follow that RF energy signal. The ice is a crystalline device. Each of the individual water molecules in the ice are essentially locked in position. They cannot follow the
repeater timeout.
The water molecules in the ice cannot follow the signal. The ice cube runs ice cold. Water has a dielectric constant of 81. Ice has a dielectric constant of 3. It's a very different material, even though it's the exact same water. As such, you take your frozen hamburger out of the freezer and you put it in your microwave oven. And you turn on the microwave oven full blast. You get a very strange result. Some little portion of the frozen hamburger patty will eventually melt, turn into liquid water, and it gets heated and gets cooked real fast. The frozen portions don't cook at all. You get this weird mixture of food that's cooking and food that's absolutely raw, even though it's right, you know, a fraction of an inch apart in the exact same hamburger patty. That's the reason why you've got a defrost cycle in your microwave oven, where it runs a very low amount of power, turns it on and off periodically to slowly unfreeze the ice before you apply the real power to cook the food. Ice doesn't cook. You put a snowball in a microwave oven on a winter day alongside of a glass of water. It's an interesting experiment. The snowball sits there and nothing happens, and the water will boil. Therefore, people who have got ice on their microwave dish, and they lose a lot of sleep about that, they don't have to. It's almost transparent. Unless you've got a very thick layer of ice on the feed horn, the ice on your microwave dish is not a detriment. Wonder if you've done any experiments along these lines with microwave dishes on DirecTV like stuff, that show. From HYYY, KTYW, the TechNet.
Oh, hey, Adam, I was just going to rewind a little bit and go back to what you said about the power line towers. Those things are actually 158 kV on each line to ground, I believe, I know because I asked. There have been many carriers putting stuff on those towers for years. I mean, probably going back about 15 years or more, they've been putting stuff on those towers. In some parts of the area of the county, you get people getting irate because they see people working on it. It's in their backyard, especially like in Ronkonkoma, because those lines go right down the spine of the island, east and west. And they're all pretty much like right in people's backyard, so the people can't help but seeing the people and the antenna crews go up there and put the equipment on the tower. As nice as those things are to the power, to the cellular companies, they're a pain in the ass, and I'll tell you why. Because if anything happens to the antenna systems up on the tower, bad feed line goes bad, antenna goes bad, something else goes bad up top, LIPA will absolutely not turn off the power from May till about the end of September till October. You got to put a request in, they refuse to turn off the power. It just won't do it. So it's a nice structure, just like a water tank, but it's got some very bad points to it also. And if you had to look at the electromagnetic field intensity of the 158 kV wires compared to the intensity of the RF coming out of cell antennas, which have maybe about 8, 10 dB gain, 12 dB gain or something like that, with multiple 100-watt transmitter running in some locations, who's going to win?
You said that they won't turn off the power in order to allow a repair to be done. Does that mean absolutely no repair can be done? Or is there somebody with a hazardous duty pay goes up there and does the repair? And maybe with a very carefully used cherry picker on the outside. So are those absolutely non-maintainable, Joe? The B2RYY, T2RIW,
WS2N?
As far as I know, with the company I worked for, because they had some engineers that wanted to do before they started putting an automated type of down tilting system on the antennas, sometimes you get engineers running tests on the network and they decide, okay, I'd like to have this site have 2 degrees down tilt or 3 degrees down tilt and it has zero right now, maybe for the interference or who knows what. They will not turn off the power because you have to go out and work on these things with a 150-foot condor. That's how they send the crews up top to work on this stuff, the LIPA crews. They won't turn the power off because it happened many times before. I don't know if their philosophy or their thinking has changed in the past couple of years since I've been out of the, not involved in that anymore, but when I worked, there was about 15 years ago, They will not turn the power off on those power lines. Other locations, it's a different story, but not those, because those things are, they're carrying a huge amount of current east and west to the distribution centers.
Now, Paul recognized, I'm going to go back to Joe for a minute, you said 150-foot condor. You said that real fast. We're all supposed to know what that means. Is that a very special kind of cherry picker or crane-like device? What is a 150-foot condor, Joe? Over to you, Joe.
Like a hydraulic type of boom truck. Has a bucket at the end. And what I mean by 150, it can go up to 150 feet, I think, at maximum elevation. And those things are typically about, what are those things? It's like 120s, I think they said those things are, something like that, in that range, 110, 120. So the condors can definitely go up as high enough to those things to do any work on them. There's a whole thing to do in working on those things. They have to shut off the power. If they were going to work on it, they have to shut off the power, verify the power shut off, and actually ground each line separately to ground before they allow anybody else to go up there and work on the antenna system. So it's a really big, long, lengthy to-do to work on those things during those months, like typically from like May to about the end of September to October, because with peak power loads for air conditioning and the likes, they just won't do it. They wouldn't reroute the power. It's it's a problem. Go ahead, Paul. I guess it's over to you.
Yeah, it looks like what they did here is they had an independent pad with an independent tower that went up. So I saw the truck come in with the long tower. They were getting ready to put it up in the air, I guess, probably later in that day. They had riggers there and all. But I never saw the completed job, but the way it looked to me, I'll have to ride over there again. It looked like it was independent, but you know, all the wires and towers are up. This thing was kind of like in line with it. So maybe they wouldn't have to shut the power off. Although I still wouldn't want to go up between all those lines with the cherry picker. I call them cherry pickers, but when you're calling it a condor, it sounds like a big cherry picker. That's pretty much what they had here. But I'll have to look at the finished version. Maybe take a picture of it. Back to you, Dick.
I have one question. Of the ones of the what you saw, and I have seen those elsewhere, and I don't recall if they were actually put up between the wires or the outside edge of one of the wires, like, you know, still in their property, but, not near enough of a wire we would have had a servicing problem. I think in some locations I've seen them actually go up between the wires, but the monopoles they put up, I think in some cases, also are not quite as tall as the power poles themselves.
Yeah, when I draw past it, didn't look like it would be taller than the power poles. So you're probably right about that. And I did get a good look at the location of the pad. You know, it had a concrete pad board with all these. They look like. Oh, they had an inch and a half studs sticking out. I'm probably going to bump them down with big inch and a half nuts. And it looked like a 14 or 16 bolt pattern. So, yeah, it's going to be a substantial installation. Back to you, Joe.
From what you saw, Paul, I think that pole was put in between the wires. In other words, the 138 kilovolt wires, some of them are on the east side of the pole, some of them on the west side of the pole, and the new auxiliary pole for the cell site was put up in between those wires, I believe. Is that your recollection also, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yes, that's what I remember seeing. I'll double check, but I think it was pretty sure. It was definitely in line. If you were going to stand between two poles, it would be definitely in line, favoring one side, though. Back to you.
Now, here's a question for you, Joe. In theory, you and I could design a 150-foot cherry picker. picker-like device, where the actual cherry picker is made out of non-conducting materials. It's operated hydraulically, so fluids are flowing through pieces of tubing to operate these pistons to do all of the work of positioning everything on that cherry picker. And if you have a very well-trained cherry picker operator, I think even with those wires live, you'd be able to put a person in that bucket and send them up there to do work on those antennas. Is that out of the question? W-H-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and the tech man.
The boom on those things are constructed out of fiberglass, because I took a good look at them. They're not metal, they're fiberglass. And, by the way, they have to be certified by a company at least once per year that the entire bucket and all the supporting structure, including the hydraulic line, is voltage tested once a year by a certified company that certified that, because if you're going to operate that near high voltage lines, it's got to be certified that it's not going to be conductive in any way possible. This is just, from what I understand at the time, life is, you know, with their equipment, them sending their people up there. They can send the guys up between the things. I've seen them work. I guess the power's actually on, but for any length of time, they would probably prefer to have the power off. Like I said, between like May till about the end of September, because of current loads on those things. They were extremely resistant on turning off the power on those circuits because they're major lines. I mean, other lines in other areas that are 69 kV or 37 kV, because sometimes they put stuff on top of those poles also, that's a different story. But those things carry a lot of juice, so they were very resistant on turning that stuff off. That's all I can really tell you about something from what I remember. It's, you know, it's going back about 14, 15 years ago when they worked for the last wireless company.
Yeah, Luco and Con Ed and PSENG linemen that work on high voltage circuits, they wear these very thick, long rubber gloves that go up to their almost up to their shoulder. They wear a rubber suit, so their whole body is protected in such a way that if they come in contact with those high voltage lines, they're relatively safe. If the bucket truck itself, this condor as you called it, is itself non-conductive. If at worst the operator makes a mistake and the boom comes in light contact with the 138 kilovolt line, in theory nothing would happen. So it sounds to me like, is Condor a particular brand name of a particular style of a non-conductive bucket truck that can do this kind of work even between May and September, when that line is live? Is it possible to do work with that line live with the right equipment and a properly trained human being? W2RYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
I believe Condor is the actual company who made these things. They own several of them. To specifically work on those type of line arrangements. They don't have a great deal of those poles around. You typically see them only, there's some going north and south, but most of them are pretty much going like east and west, because they do carry 158 kV lines. They had the capability of actually going up to 345 if they had Shoreham online, but they never used them that high though. But I believe Condor is the actual company, a company that makes these type of trucks that are able, what you call a cherry picker, that's capable of going up to like 150 foot, like, or they can go up that high. I mean, the thing got to go straight up, it's on an angle, but they can reach stuff, like 150 feet up above the ground. And those power poles, like, think of like 110, 120, maybe 130 at the top of those things. But that's all I can really tell you, Dick. I don't know what kind of amperage you're talking about flowing in those wires. The only thing is I could tell you that I've ever remember seeing was being one local distribution place over in Port Washington, and the company had a wireless cell site there, And when I was done doing my work, I walked into the room because there was a guy on the property at the same time. Saved by the TOT. And I happen to remember seeing, he has a digital display above this rack of equipment. And I said, what's that? He said, that's the voltage output the current. And this thing was putting out 69 kV voltage at approximately 110,000 amps of current. That's only a small distribution station. So I can just imagine what kind of current you got flowing in those 158 kV wires.
WS2N, if you want a power outage report.
Yeah, go ahead and give us a... Are you telling me because of the high winds, we've already had power outage on Long Island? Is that what you're saying, Paul? WS2N, KGIW.
Yes, I keep watching the number creep up. Right now we're up to a total of 6,216. Nassau County's got a little over 2,000. Suffolk has a little over 4,145. And Rock Hockham just joined a group of 125. Usually if there's a storm, you know, I'll wind up going down. So during the night, if I don't come back, I'll probably be hooking up a generator. Back to you, Dick. That's the numbers right now. Where are you? Are you in Huntington? I think you're pretty safe. 170.
And you're looking at some kind of a map showing you where the outage is, I presume. And are we talking about tiny little patches where a cable going down a street is damaged by a falling tree, as opposed to a whole community being locked out because a 158 kilovolt line has failed? Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, KGIW.
Yeah, they give you customers, the amount of customers, that's what I was giving you. It was a total of 6,216 on the island. And then they give you active outages, 172. So, you know, that 172 affects all these 6,000 customers. For instance, if I go down Rock Hockham's, they show 9 o'clock, 9:15, they would restore the power. They usually get it on before that. You know, I think they give you a number and you're happy when it goes on earlier. Back to you, sir.
Paul, have you heard any high winds in your QTH this evening? Go ahead.
Yes, I have. That's one thing I should get is an anemometer, but I don't have that. I need them now. So yeah, you're gonna, you know, with all the wet ground and the high winds, you're gonna have a problem. By the way, this is you can get this site. This is the PSE&G site. Check, so you bring up the power outages. And click on how many outages. And they eventually give you a chart. You can bring this up. I haven't saved on all my computers.
Now, Paul, you saw the base concrete pad with 16 volts, inch and a half diameter, coming out of it, where they're going to install probably 100 or 120 foot or 150 foot pole to it. And that most likely is a steel pole they're going to install. I'm guessing a steel pole. Many of these monopoles are steel. Well, maybe somebody makes one out of fiberglass, similar to the construction of a windmill blade. If that was a steel pole being installed and you had a super high wind and that pole tilted over and touched a 158 kilovolt line, boy, you're going to get all kinds of smoke and flames. Do I have reason to believe that that pole being installed that you saw the base of could possibly be a non-conducting pole? Got a guess on that one, Paul? WS2N, KQIW.
I don't think it would matter. I drove past it, but I went by real quick. I had the road blocked off, you know, with flagmen. And I couldn't get really that close to it. I drove the length of it. So, you know, I'm gonna say it was steel, and it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think could have a 200 mile an hour wind come through it. I mean, this concrete pad with these massive bulbs coming out of it, I don't see going anywhere, especially with the steel. I like overkill, and that's what this was.
Yeah, steel is the traditional way, and I'm guessing it's steel. And like you say, maybe they've made it rated for 200 mile an hour wind, and the 158 kilovolt tower itself is probably good for that kind of a wind. Maybe the wires on it are not, the pole being installed is close to the tower, therefore there's not much room for the wire to sway where the new pole is going, so to speak. So even if they did make the pole out of insulated material, that wouldn't solve the problem because the transmission lines going up to the cell site antenna are coaxial cables. They are conductive. So if that insulated pole did tilt over to one side and the transmission line came in contact with the 158 kilovolt line, you're going to get smoke and flame. Although you and I could design a coaxial cable that has a fusible link to it, so that if it comes in contact with a 158 kilovolt line, the fusible link burns out. Cell site is off the air, but you're no longer creating a short on the 138 kilovolt line. I see that as a possibility. There's a business there, Paul. Want to go in business? WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, 100, high risk business. Wow. I don't know if you saw any clips on what they're doing in Puerto Rico, these guys are putting cables up and using helicopters and all kinds of equipment. And now they want to get rid of them. They don't think they had enough experience. They want to bring somebody else in. I don't know, some complicated problem. But the few scenes I saw, they're using helicopters to get these big, whatever they're doing up there. You know, they have those tall towers just like we have here. They are really in bad shape in that place. They want more people, and wow. But I'm assuming that the storm must have knocked these poles down or something. I think we're about 150 mile an hour winds. So I guess you could knock the poles down here on Long Island if you had a big enough storm. Unless the original poles maybe weren't that strong in Puerto Rico. They're rebuilding that whole main. I guess what they would call the grid, WS1. There's a job for you, Dick. There's definitely a job for you. Did you hear how much they're paying these guys to work down there?
Yeah, it turns out the whole flop came about because the original company from Wyoming only had two permanent employees, but they knew the names and addresses of some very skilled people, and they put 40 or 60 very skilled people at very high salaries. I think numbers like $350 an hour or some crazy number like that. So they got these 40 or 60 people down there rebuilding the Puerto Rican system. The pictures I saw led me to believe that the high tension towers were still standing in many cases, but the wires on them had blown off. So they're replacing those wires. So these highly skilled people are in the middle of rebuilding that electrical system in Puerto Rico because of this political slap as to how they got the job. Apparently nobody else bid on it. They're now canceling it. And the process of taking those people back out and shipping in a new group of people is going to create 10 weeks of delay of reestablishing the electrical system in Puerto Rico. So it looks like some really dumb decisions are being made now, after the fact, after the people installed and they're doing the work. But I know that some of these highly skilled people doing hazardous work, high voltage, high altitude, are being paid some very high salaries. Give us some words on that one, Joe. W2LYY, K2LIW. I think you should leave them alone.
I'm in. the company's in Whitefish, Montana. It has like two or three permanent employees. They just hired a bunch, like, just 70 people down there, plus I think more to hire after that.
An experienced journeyman, I guess you'd call it. That's a guy, I guess, experienced electrician. They get paid $3.19 an hour, and the other guys who don't are not journeymen get paid like $2.85.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Hi, you. Yeah, we lost the $305 and $295 an hour, but the this is duty work. They're worth it. And the people are on site doing the work. Why in the world interrupt that? I mean, a smart person does not burn a bridge until he's got a place to go. Until you've got another standby company ready to move in instantaneously, you don't cancel the previous contract of people that are doing the work, and you got nothing to complain about the quality of the work they're doing. For all we know, they're licensed people doing doing mil-spec work, so to speak. Who is the person who said comment? Give us your full call letters and name, and then proceed with your comment. H-U-R-I-W and TechNet. My name is Dick.
Dick, it's George, KD2FIU. I heard yesterday Whitefish is charging the government $465 an hour for this activity. I heard that in more than one report. KD2FIU.
Another wood piece across the top of the insulators up on top of that. There were very few steel high tension poles.
Okay, we heard George, another person. When you take the guys who are qualified, being paid $2.95 and $3.15 an hour, the individual employee, and then in order to hire that person with all the overhead to run the company, to pay $415 an hour for that employee, that maybe is the right price. You and I are not used to these kind of prices for this very skilled, hazardous duty work. The other person who's talking about the tower, give us your call letters and name, and I think you're telling us that some of the actual high-tension towers blew down and had to be replaced. Over to that other person besides George, K2RIW and the TechNet. We'll wait for the beeps and then give us that information, sir. Start up with your name and your call letters.
Yes, Dick, this is mic number two. I was saying that there are very few tall steel high-tension towers in Puerto Rico. Most of them were wood. They were very tall telephone pole-like structures with maybe three across and a long heavy-duty telephone pole horizontal across the top and the high-tension lines on top of those poles. There were very few steel high-tension towers, and some of them did come down. The ones that didn't come down, the wires stayed in place.
So, Mike, these highly skilled people, are they rebuilding some of those towers that came down, reestablishing new ones, installing wires on the ones that are still standing? What do you believe is their major work? And do they have the right hardware on site to do this work and to make the whole system connect together and be wired up? What's your thinking on that one, Mike? K1MJM, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Dick, from what I saw, they weren't working on the high-tension towers while I was there. I came home about just under 2 weeks ago, and during the 3 weeks I was there, I did not see anybody working on the high-tension towers. They were mostly focusing in the cities around the power plants, like in San Juan, Ponce. They were focusing mostly in the cities around the power plants. I didn't see anyone in the countryside working on the high-voltage towers at the time.
Hey, Mike, number two, you just gave us a mouthful. Sounds to me like you've spent a couple of weeks as a ham radio volunteer or some other kind of volunteer in Puerto Rico. Tell us, what did you volunteer for? What were you doing? How did you get there? Give us some words on this, Mike. And I presume this is volunteer work. K1MJM, K2RIW and the TechNet.
Roger that, Dick. The ARRL requested 50 volunteers. They took the first 20, of which I was one. We set up communications all over the island, including FEMA headquarters and American Red Cross headquarters. That's probably actually plenty of information out there. I don't know how much detail you want to get into.
Okay, you were setting up communications, and I think some of what FEMA is doing is distributing water. I mean, the people who are in the hinterlands no longer have a house, no longer have power, no longer have flowing water, and they're in a high humidity, high heat temperature. The first priority is to keep people alive is to give them water. The second priority is to give them food and or shelter. You probably know about My Little Crusade saying that they should be shipping them these Lifesaver is the name of the thing. It's a kind of a 2-liter like bottle that'll give you filtered water. You put dirty water in it and it filters it. Filters out not only bacteria, but will filter out viruses because it's a 15 micron filter. And the 2-liter size filter will give you 6,000 liters of water. That gives a human being, a single human being, enough drinkable water for the next couple of years. And of course, less than a penny a day to operate that. So rather than pass out water to these people and have to come back every couple of days and give them water again, to give them those filter devices is a much nicer way to solve the problem as I see it. But it takes a break in conventional thinking to approach it that way, and I think FEMA doesn't want to think about that. So I presume some of the people in the very rural areas with no transportation, no power, and their highest priority to stay alive is to have water. That's my guess. K1MJM, K2IW in the TechNet.
Just to set the record straight, Dick, I was there for 3 weeks. I was out every day for 3 weeks. I did not see one FEMA person out in the field. It was Red Cross, some Salvation Army, Reserves, National Guard, and U.S. Army. I did not see one FEMA person in the field. They had a big presence at the headquarters, but I did not see anyone out in the field. The Red Cross is the main suppliers, providers of water and food, and the Salvation Army is helping a lot too, and the National Guard, Army, and Reserves are doing a lot of work clearing the roads.
For the people who live very far from San Juan, because the island's 110 miles long, and they need water every single day, how in the world is that water getting to them, if you happen to know, Mike, K1MJM, K2IW?
Roger, the Red Cross is distributing truckloads of water, cases and cases of water. Quite a few trucks. Also, there are local companies that are providing water in potable water trucks. And they are, the Red Cross is providing some filtration, things called life straws, which are individual single person filter straws, which we used a lot of when we were there. And I can tell you they work because I didn't get sick.
Okay, those life straws are the smaller version of what I'm talking about. All right, that's an improvement. So you give him this a Lifesaver device or life straw device, you're giving a person the ability to stay into his home community and drink the local muddy water, so to speak. It filters out all the bacteria, all of the viruses, all of the contaminant materials. I think it can filter everything except salt. I don't think it'll desalinate water, but everything else. So you give a guy one of those water filtration devices, you've now given him water for the next 6 months, so to speak. That's a hell of a lot nicer than distributing bottles of water to him every few days. It's quicker, more efficient, and he doesn't have to keep coming to a metropolitan area to pick up bottles of water. He can stay in his own community, rebuilding his house or doing whatever. So I'm glad to see that they're slowly coming around to that one. So you saw people, these electrical company people, rebuilding the system at the lower voltage level, at the distribution level, not the transmission level, is what I think you're saying. You saw them rebuilding the electrical equipment at the power station. And my guess is that was working very well, and for them, for some crazy political reason, to say this is an unusual company, and we're going to kick them out and replace them with somebody else, but they didn't have another someone else to replace them with. So you're burning a bridge before you got a place to go. It seems to me like they're doing it backwards. K1MJM, am I misunderstanding this one, Mike? KURIM.
No, I think that sounds right. I believe when I was there, which I've been home for a week and a half now, when I was there, I don't think they had the people or the equipment there at the time to work on the bigger towers. They did have the local the power company people in place to work locally around the power plants and in the cities, but I don't think the people were available at the time. I don't have any comment on what happened since then. I can only tell you what I saw.
I have seen a few news reports which supposedly were taken in Puerto Rico. Now, I don't know. Maybe it really was an advertisement by the Wyoming company. But in these news reports that I've seen over the last few days, you saw people on top of high-tension distribution towers doing the work of installing wires. And this looked like a rather dangerous work. Looked like very highly skilled people doing it. And if that was really going on in Puerto Rico, and now they're going to kick them out, that sounds like a dumb thing to do. Okay. I think we've gone through most of the questions that Joe just gave us. I'm going to go over to Roy if he's available, AC2GS, because if I know Roy, 3 weeks ago he started something called the Physics and Science section of the TechNet. He's got all kinds of science and physics questions that he uses on his TechNet, which is on the Kings County Radio Club, two times per month. So I'll bet you've got a nice physics puzzle or science puzzle for us, Roy. That's a guess on my part. AC2GS, if you're there, Roy. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comments on Puerto Rico?
Stand by, Roy. Who's the person with a comment on Puerto Rico? Wait for the beeps. Give us your call letters and your name, and then give us your Puerto Rico comment. You got it, sir.
Yeah, KC1 Sierra Alpha. It's Sam. Also up there. About maybe a week or 10 days ago, I saw you come up those poles. Someone said they had 5,000 of those poles on order. They did not have replacements for the ones that were broken. So that may explain why they're not working on the long transmission lines. Back over to you.
Okay, thank you for that, Sam. So that's some of the hardware that's been ordered and may be ordered by this company. And in fact, the company's got a great big price for this highly skilled work, which requires a whole lot of new hardware to be purchased, shipped, and installed. For all we know, it's the right price. For somebody to say, gee, that sounds expensive, I'm going to kick them out. And it's a company with only two permanent employees. I don't like that, and I'm going to kick them out. And it happens to be a company from a town in Wyoming. That's the exact same town as one of our senators. So somebody's coming up with the harebrained idea that the senator was somehow involved in the selection of the company. He claims he knows nothing about it. Sounds to me like somebody's really jumping the gun on this whole procedure of kicking them out of there. I think they ought to study it a little bit more before doing a dumb action. AC2GS, give us any subject you'd like to talk about, Roy. AC2GS, KQRIW.
Hey, this is AC2GS here, and thanks, Dick. I just want to mention to the people out there that we still are doing the mailbag. We're trying to do the mailbag, so if anyone knows anyone who has any questions and wants to submit, the email address is technet@ac2gs, that's alpha charlie 2 golf sierra.com. again, technet@ac2gs.com. And just as an aside, the Secretary of the Interior, Zinke, is the guy who lived in the same small town, and his son just happened to have worked for that organization over the summer. And it's a very strange contract that demands that you can't take them to court if cost overruns are semi-ridiculous. So, I don't know. It's something a little fishy out there.
But as long as they're being properly monitored during the contract, why worry? I mean, to wait until the contract is over and say you didn't do it right and then sue them is crazy. You should be monitoring during the procedure because the procedure is going to take 6 months. If you're not watching them during that 6 months, watching how your money is being spent, then you're being very foolish. Over to you, Roy. Get your eyes at it.
Well, I certainly don't want to turn this into the political net, but you know, the problem is that it's a very strange contract. Now, you know, if they come to some compromise where they take out the part that they can't be sued if they find that they're wasting a lot of money, that's certainly an option. But just leaving a weird contract that says under no circumstance can you sue us in case we take the money and run, it's a little bit dubious. And it's all done with subcontractors. You know, they probably could just cut out the middlemen. But that's politics. Getting back to what you were talking about, your IT guy, you said that people who don't know what they don't know aren't that bad. That's problematic, in my opinion. I prefer people who just don't know anything. When you don't know that you don't know something, there's actually a term for that. It's Dunning-Kruger effect, and it's a psychological problem where people misunderstand their lack of knowledge about a subject and go on and on about it. And there's an exact opposite called imposter effect, which is people who know a lot but don't think they know that much.
Yeah, a person who knows a lot and makes believe he doesn't know a lot, sometimes he's just being humble or being doubtful because, let's face it, no matter what you know, if you're smart enough, you know you don't know it all. Mother Nature is always a lot deeper than any reasonable amount of knowledge to try to explain Mother Nature, for instance. But when it comes to being humble, I can beat you in humbleness, Roy. I'm more humble than you. I'm a better bragger. Over to you, Roy. Take your eyes on you.
I'm telling you, Dick, the more I learn, the more I realize what little I actually know of any of this. But going on to some aspects of getting off psychology and going on to physics again, I thought I might clear up a possible confusion from 2 weeks earlier. We were talking about phosphorescence, we were talking about phosphors, and we were talking about phosphorus. Phosphors are not the same as phosphorus, and some people might get that confused. Although phosphorescence and phosphors come from the same root as phosphorus. Phosphorus is a metal, an element that, under the effect of oxygen, produces a very low level of illumination in the dark. And the principle was kind of grafted onto the whole concept of phosphorescence, except that phosphorus itself is not phosphorescent. It's something called chemiluminescence. So, just to confuse matters, phosphors don't have any phosphorus in them, but they're all phosphorescent. And you see that in cathode ray tubes, you see that in old television sets, you see that in highly reflective material that seems to glow in the dark for hours, and it's a rather fascinating reason that it does that. Let me drop for a sec. Well, at least I feel that it's fascinating. What happens with phosphorescence? What happens with most things is light hits it, the electron jumps up to a certain level, sits there for a very, very short fraction of a second, drops back down to the ground state, and re-emits a photon. In phosphorescence, it jumps up, but then instead of going back to its ground state, it gets stuck on the way down in a so-called forbidden zone, which quantum mechanically makes it very, very, very difficult for it to do anything but sit there. And so it has to use very, very improbable ways of getting back to the ground state, which is why some very interesting phosphors will glow an hour or two after you cut out the light that's charging them up. So that's my little bit on phosphorescence.
Yeah, the hands on the watch that I'm wearing right now, when I put it under a bright light and then go into the dark, it glows very nicely, but it gets dim pretty fast. I think starting in World War II, they used to make a kind of paint for watch dials and instrument panels on aircraft which I believe had a small amount of radioactive material mixed into the paint to give it continuous light output. You might want to give us a few words on that, Roy. AC2GS, dangerous materials, I believe, and I think they're now outlawed to some degree. K2RIW.
But that was back in our very foolish past. There's a lot of very toxic materials that people took for granted. One of those materials that glow in the dark that people loved was radium. And of course, you know the scientist famous for radium, Madame Curie. Most of her family died of cancers due to radiation poisoning, so that's where that goes. Also, they did tritium as an activator. Now, a lot of these things, with tritium at least, they're alpha emitters to a degree, so if you encase them in a piece of glass, they're relatively harmless. But they used to have these young women who would lick the brushes and put the material on the brush and paint the dials in the hands of the clock. And eventually, and it doesn't happen overnight, so it's not obvious, they developed head and neck cancers, mouth cancers, all kinds of nasty things. Because, you know, putting it between glass is fine, but if you paint it on your tongue, that's not no real protection. So that was the story as far as radioactive materials getting into people in a serious way.
The painted dials on my watch, after I've charged it up with a light bulb and then go into the dark, it gets dimmer and dimmer, and eventually I can no longer see it. I believe it goes down to essentially zero light output. And I think in modern day, there is no solution to that other than adding radioactive material to that paint. That's a guess on my part. Am I even close to that, Paul? I mean, Roy? AC2GS, K2IW.
Yes, Dick. Right now, you know, people, you say radiation to people and they get scared, as they probably should. So all these things are phosphorescent. They're phosphors. And so they can collect photons and charge up. They're like a light battery or light capacitors, if you will. And they'll discharge their photons slowly throughout a set period of time, depending upon the chemistries involved. But there's no radioactive material. It's all phosphorescence in action.
K2EJ, go ahead, Eric. And how do you make dials stay bright for a long period of time with no power?
As you said, no power. I just wanted to point out that beyond the various different kinds of powered phosphorescent types of illuminators, one of the things that they're making is a phosphor that gets excited by infrared light. And I've seen military panels where they actually light this phosphor up with infrared light. So there are other ways in which you can use phosphor that requires excitation in some form.
When I use my green laser pointer and I aim it at various things, I've made a discovery that when I aim it at what is called day glow tape, it's a kind of tape that's very bright on its reflection. It comes in various colors. And one of the good colors is sort of an orange-red-like color. When I aim my green laser pointer at almost any object in the room, I get a green reflection. When I aim it at this day glow tape, I get a reddish reflection. Now, part of what's going on, I am guessing, is that my laser pointer really has a frequency doubling crystal inside that gives me 535 nanometers of output, but I think it's got a 1,070 nanometers of infrared light going into it, and a certain amount of that infrared light feeds through the crystal and is exciting the day glow tape, is my guess, because the tape looks extra bright and the wrong color when I aim my green laser pointer at it. I bet you there's some pretty fancy physics going on there. I'm going to go over to Eric and then Roy in that order on this one. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the tech man.
RWK2EJ. I don't know if you've ever looked at day glow type tapes or paint under ultraviolet light. It definitely shows you the light.
the paint or the tape itself has a phosphor which is being excited. And what you're seeing from your green laser pointer is not a doubling of frequency, it's a secondary emission. It's an emission of the material that's on the tape itself emitting light. So what you're doing is exciting the molecules and they're giving off photons. Anyway, that's my take on it. KTRIWK3GS.
Yeah, I know that a re-emission is taking place, but I'm seeing a reddish reflection, which is a lower frequency than the green of my laser pointer. So, I was guessing it's being charged by the infrared feed through of my laser pointer, and then emitting its favorite color. That's my guess. See what Roy should say about this. One of you have done any experiments along these lines, Roy. AC2GS, KTRIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS. I haven't done any direct experiments, but green lasers are infamous for using optical doublers. They're like optical mixers. They take two photons in the infrared spectrum, and they mix them to twice the frequency, which is green. It's a very easy method. It's far easier than to manufacture green laser LEDs. It's not terribly efficient, so a significant portion of the infrared runs right through it without doubling to green. So my surmise is it's primarily the infrared non-mixed emissions that are exciting the phosphors that are giving you the effect that you're seeing.
The best kind of mixer you and I know as far as radio circuits are concerned, Roy, contains diodes. Diodes are devices that, with one polarity, they conduct a lot. With the other polarity, they don't conduct very much. Therefore, it's a very non-linear device. You put a bipolar sine wave into it, and the sine wave is sometimes positive and sometimes negative. You get output a different waveform, and by the laws of Fourier series and Fourier transform, that more exotic waveform coming out of this nonlinear device has other low frequency components, higher frequency components, second, third, fourth, harmonic. In the case of a crystal, I'm having trouble seeing the diodes that are in the crystal. A crystal material to me is something that at first looks like it should be purely linear, but some kind of nonlinearity is required in order to do frequency doubling. So how does the crystal do it? Is there the equivalent of microscopic diodes in there? AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I don't know if you can really describe them as diodes. They're not perfect crystals. If you go looking at what kind of crystals they use as optical mixers, they're very esoteric, and they tend to be doped with impurities. And so that distorts the crystal lattice and distorts the electron orbital potentials, and so odd things happen when you excite the electrons. And I think that it apparently pushes it in a very nonlinear fashion and allows you to kind of step up the electron excitations to twice the amount of the initiating photon. So I don't know if it quite is the same as a diode, but it certainly is a nonlinear crystal lattice.
In order to frequency double, I have to take the pure sine wave of infrared input, 1070 nanometers roughly, is where my actual laser inside my laser pointer is operating. It shines a wave into this crystal, and now for the crystal to make higher frequency harmonics, it has to present some kind of nonlinearity, conducting differently on the positive wave side of the waveform versus the negative is one way, or to operate in steps. In other words, as you climb up the voltage of a sine wave, if the voltage coming out does not move in a sinusoidal smooth manner, if it's like a stair step, so to speak, if the voltage coming out is a stair step equivalent of what goes in, then those stair steps definitely represent higher frequency components. I'm wondering what kind of nonlinearity is in that crystal. Is it making staircase steps? Is it conducting differently on the positive half of the waveform versus the negative half of the waveform? there's probably a large number of ways it can be nonlinear. Just adding a doping material, a foreign material to the crystal, I'm having trouble seeing how that in itself creates nonlinearity. Do you have a guess, Roy, as to what is the nature of the nonlinearity?